So we just need to co-write a book.
We should. Absolutely. Oh, don't play. We will. I'll be at the typewriter.
If we're allowed to
tonight.
Do that. Yes. We may not be allowed to do that in a couple of months. So
that's why I got a typewriter, okay? So they take our computers.
Every 4 years, the United States of America holds a presidential election, putting a number of ideas, ideals, personalities, and historical trajectories on a given ballot. On November 8th, 2016, that tradition continued with the election of Donald Trump Sr. of New York. Welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Today's guest is Dr. Zandria Robinson, an ethnographer, writer, speaker, and assistant professor of sociology at Rhodes College. Dr. Robinson's work focuses on inequality, race, class, gender and sexuality, Black feminism, popular culture, and media, which makes her a prime candidate for tonight's discussion of yesterday's general election results. I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. So welcome, Dr. Robinson.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Is it okay if I call you Zandria?
Yes.
Okay.
Please, Jesus.
Perfect. I've been telling people we're friends.
Yes.
I hope that's okay.
That's real. I was your friend before, like on Twitter. I was like, oh my God, I'm his friend. So glad to know that we're friends.
Because you know, like when
you think so too.
Absolutely. Because you know when you like know a famous person and you're like, but you don't actually know them, but you want people to think you know them? Yeah. Like that's how I am about Dr. Robinson. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, this is historic. A lot of amazing things have happened.
In a sucky way.
Yes.
Yes.
things have happened in the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Things that some of us did not expect, some of us saw coming. You are an ethnographer. And we had a conversation about this a couple mm-hmm. of weeks ago. And ethnography is listening. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and kind of frame our discussion tonight?
Yeah, I am frequently listening to what people are saying. When I was little, you know, the old people call it eavesdropping. You ear hustling. so I was an ear hustler as a little girl. And then I continued on and found out that you could ear hustle for a living and get a degree in ear hustling. So that's what I did as a sociologist. And it's a combination of listening to what people say and you're watching body language, you're having, you're thinking about what's happening and looking for patterns. As you are watching people engage in the social world. And so that's what I'm doing all the time, whether it's in the classroom or I'm in some public space, I'm watching people. And I do listen to what they say, but I'm listening for what they're not saying for the most part. Mm-hmm.
So what have you heard over this? You know, we have a kind of protracted election season. Mm-hmm. Usually in the U.S. it's like 18 months long. Mm-hmm. What did you hear over that season? And then second part of that question, what did you hear yesterday, last night?
So at first, I think I was hearing whiteness doing its regular thing. And it was playing a little bit of good cop, bad cop. So there are some good cop Republicans and some bad cop Republicans. Trump was always one of the bad cops, a renegade, you know, but the idea was that, you know, we're going to reel him in. But also there was an undercurrent in the beginning, like, this is dangerous, don't do this. And then I was actually surprised to hear people's surprise when he clinched the nomination. I was like, of course, this is how the reality TV goes. The bad cop wins, and then we're going to go on from here. And people's lack of willingness to renounce him early on. I was like, we are in trouble. And then again, that undercurrent from Black folks, from folks on the radical left, was like, this is not good. This is going to be bad. And then as things sped up, you know, there were always problems with Hillary from folks on the radical left. In two ways. One, Black folks were like, and Latinx people, undocumented folks were like, you have to show up for us. And you haven't been willing to come out and show up for us. So that was a problem. And I think in terms of her status as an establishment candidate, mm-hmm. which she most certainly was, despite the fact that she was hugely qualified and so forth, like the establishment is wrapped up in that. So there was the part about her being an establishment candidate that was troubling for many people across the spectrum. There was a great bit of sexism, though, of course, around and misogyny around resistance towards her, especially when Bernie did not clinch the nomination, and she did. And so then in the run-up, I became more and more sort of resolute with the fact that she probably wasn't going to win just because of the massive amounts of sort of darts being thrown at her from multiple directions, and because I think in the media discourse, I see a lot of people have been saying today, oh, we underestimated white people. I was like, I didn't underestimate white people. I don't know what white people you know, but I did not underestimate any white people. We're exactly where I thought we were going to be. But I think that it was shocking for a lot of people to kind of grapple with the massive amount of misogyny, racism, sexism, violence, anti-immigrant sentiment, xenophobia that was wrapped up in this. But I also will say that these discourses are not different than what we've been experiencing. It's just that Donald Trump is not politically correct. The policies that have been passed or have not been passed over the past 8 years, things that are repealing women's right to control their bodies, things that are repealing and complicating people's access to the damn bathroom. Like, these are these discourses, right, enacted in policy. And because they're enshrined in some policy language, we have been trained to believe they're less violent. They're not any less violent. This isn't to say that language isn't violent, because this discourse is certainly violent, but these policies are extraordinarily violent to the very people who our president-elect has said, you know, are on the outside of our society. So I think that what I have heard is people's unwillingness to reckon with the legacy, not just of whiteness and white supremacy, but also of anti-Blackness, and in particular anti-Black misogyny, that has been an undercurrent here. I was talking with a friend of mine earlier, and she was saying, I was saying this is anti-Black misogyny, and she was saying, but Hillary is white. And I was like, but look who showed up for Hillary. They know who Hillary's constituency is when they are voting, and look how Michelle Obama was her surrogate. Like, when they are voting against Hillary, they are voting against Black women and Black queer people, and Black trans people, Black femmes. They're voting against that segment of the Black population.
Wow. That's a lot. Okay, Theology Live is over. This is... Dr. Robinson has somehow addressed every one of my questions within about 6 minutes. So thank you all so much for coming out tonight. Dr. Robinson actually has this lovely, lovely essay that is coming out soon in the Oxford American mm-hmm. called Listening for the Country, The Shape of Daddy's Hurt, which is phenomenal. And I was honored to be able to read it kind of before it's published. And one thing that you say in this essay is, and you alluded to this, you had to listen for the undercurrent. Kind of in the aftermath of your father's death, listening for his presence in the world. Can you speak to that? Listening to the undercurrent, what it means to listen to the undercurrent of a culture, of a people, of a moment.
Yeah, I think a lot about the closing words of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, who knows, but on the lower frequencies, I speak for you. Mm-hmm. And that idea is that somewhere, and this is true about Black people in America, if you listen to us, well, we do speak for everyone's pain and hurt and the violences that our society has wrought onto people. I'm not saying that we're sort of like perfect mm-hmm. martyrs, but to say that if you listen, right, we do speak for you. And so I've been fascinated. I read that book at 11, didn't know nothing. And then read it again several times over the years. But this idea of the lower frequencies, what is it that we are listening for that can't be, that isn't said? And so in that essay, I'm writing about how my father is or was this man from the Mississippi Delta who is not an emoter, like, you know, a lot of fathers who came from that time. And in order to understand who he was and what he was saying, you just had to kind of pick up on the spirit of who he was. Sometimes it was embedded in the actions. You could pick up a little thing. Sometimes it was a smirk. Sometimes it was a gesture, because he wasn't even like a hugger or he didn't say, I love you. But the love was very palpable, and you just had to be able to do it, to listen for it. If you were a person who needed to hear that, you weren't going to get it. That you weren't going to get it. And I think that I have taken that sort of being able to listen for people's emotions and listen for people's feelings that aren't being articulated in the normative ways that we expect mm-hmm. that they should be. You have to listen for that. I think that the many, many pieces about listening to the disaffected Trump supporter have missed that lower frequency listening, because it's difficult to deal with sometimes mm-hmm. that at the base we are talking about anti-blackness. You mm-hmm. can put the economy on top of that. You can put misogyny on top of that. You can put sexism. But this really significant feeling of loss of power that has come after these years of our first African-American president, that's really palpable. And there at the base is anti-blackness, and we have to be willing to listen for that. And I think that's difficult for a lot of folks.
Yeah. So you mean that when people say things like, oh, well, this, his support, his rise can be attributed to economic anxiety. Mm-hmm. you're saying that that's a euphemism,
yeah.
basically.
Oh, it's absolutely a euphemism. This isn't to say that people haven't been experiencing economic disaffection. But I will say also that a lot of support that he got was from places where unemployment was down. Mm-hmm. We have significantly low unemployment comparatively. And this group of people that people are now wanting to blame things on, rural white Americans, have been experiencing tragedy since the 1970s. And I was joking earlier, I told my mother that, because she was like, those jobs aren't coming back. And I said, no, they're not. I said, well, Trump's going to build factories in each of these communities where people will be putting Trump stamps on steaks and Trump stamps on wine. Mm-hmm. And that'll be the jobs. Yeah. And my mom says, well, that's not going to be, the kind of wages that they need. I said, of course not. Those kinds of jobs, and we haven't reckoned with that. So I'm wanting to sort of capture the very real economic anxiety. I mean, and we see it in the rise in deaths heroin addiction, mm-hmm. Percocet, you know, all these kinds of addictions that are significantly affecting rural white America, and even more so than Black America, in the sense that now the gap between the Black-white mortality rate has closed, not because Black people are living longer, but because some white people are dying sooner of this economic despair. But we have trained white people over generations in our society to think that if something is going wrong, it is somebody else's fault. Mm-hmm. It's the Mexicans, it's them Chinese, it's the Jews, it's the Blacks, it's the dogs, it's the cats, whoever it is, somebody else, you know, has done this wrong to us. And so, of course, then economic anxiety cannot be disentangled from anti-Blackness or anti-immigrant sentiment or xenophobia or misogyny. Wow. I think about the case of the man getting off for raping the unconscious woman. Like, this is both a misogynist thing that's happened. This is some class privilege that's operating. But when that man gets off, for people who are economically disaffected, that's a triumph. Mm-hmm. It's a symbolic triumph. It doesn't put food on the table, but it's a triumph. And those things, you know, the possessive investment in whiteness is a thing that helps people, it's a psychological wage that helps keep people going when things are tough. And so that's kind of my thought about what's happening there. We can talk about unemployment rates, we can talk about what has happened to rural America all day, but at the end of the day, we still have to grapple with anti-Blackness.
That is true. Can you speak a little more about, you know, President-elect Trump said to to his crowds of mm-hmm. people that Black people had nothing to lose if they voted for him. Can you say a little bit about that, but also what other communities, what other identities might fall under that category of people who he would say, or his supporters would say, are people that would have nothing to lose under his presidency? And what can you do a little vision casting of what things may be at stake come January 20th, 2017?
We have been losing. I do think that Black people have been losing. Black queer people have been losing. Black trans people have been losing. Black trans women in particular have been losing. Latinx people have been losing. Undocumented people have been losing. Differently abled people have been losing. I think that many of us have been losing in our society for a long time. There were moments when things were going okay or better than they had been. And, you know, historians, of course, want to sort of stick to a narrative of progress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Slavery's over. Mm-hmm. Jim Crow's over. These lines in history, these walls. But it's much more fluid than that. The things that pass, that continue on, are very palpable and contribute to our losing. That goes back to my sentiment that these policies, the ugliness of them towards these various groups, have been there all along. So I think what we'll see is a continuation of the things that have always been at stake, which are our lives. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if we're talking specifics, we're talking about women's right to choose. We're talking about trans people's right to be. We're talking about lesbian, gay people's right to be. But when I think about those things in particular, for instance, like, Tennessee still doesn't have legislation that stops us from discriminating against lesbian and gay people on the job. Mm-hmm. And many states don't. And so
I think
this is
like 29.
Yes, right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is just like a long battle that we have been fighting. So in the sense that there is there is nothing to lose that he was articulating, I think that there is an underlying pessimism in there that acknowledges that we are losing, not because of some kind of structural phenomenon, like he's not being sophisticated in that way. He just thinks that we're losing because we're not working hard enough. So those are the two kinds of, but when I say that we have been losing, I'm talking about we are at a structural disadvantage here on the margins, whether it's race margins, sex and sexuality margins, gender margins, ability margins, we are losing.
Wow. And what do you hear in these marginalized communities as far as resilience, as far as survival, as far as strength?
Yeah, I mean, people are surviving. I remember back when so many people had been killed and it was on so many of our minds, and then The Wiz came on and there was like, oh my God, The Wiz, and people were crying. And I was like, Black people will find some joy anywhere. And I think back to our ancestors who passed down this joy. I mean, they gave us this legacy of joy during the most troubling and violent and terrible and terrifying times. And then we are the survivors. Mm. And so we survived because they gave us joy. So I do feel like there is a tremendous amount of resilience. People are talking about it. People are saying, you know, we mourn today, we fight tomorrow. Like I was telling you earlier, I'm not fighting tomorrow. I'm still eating cake tomorrow. I may eat cake for the rest of the year. But also part of that is I feel like our very survival, if we haven't taken anything else from this election, the fact that we are here and breathing pisses a lot of people off. We are winning in a way by just surviving. The fact that we're able to gather here in this space and in love and to love each other through this is, you know, makes people angry. Yes. And who would think that? Like, we are definitely in like a Voldemort kind of space. You know, Voldemort don't want nobody to be happy. Like, don't be happy. Don't love. Can't you just kill people? You gotta stop us from loving too. You know, so there's that's happening, but we persist. Mm-hmm. We persist.
I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with ethnographer and professor Dr. Zandria Robinson. We're discussing what she heard ethnographically in our most recent election. This persistence, this spirit of persistence that you perceive in these various communities, I think a lot of the questions that are that are already emerging from this is, you know, I think about my friends who are really working for reproductive justice. Mm-hmm. I think about my friends who are deeply involved in Black Lives Matter. I think about my friends who are deeply involved in protecting LGBTQ people, whether it be from violence around restrooms or violence around unemployment due to discriminatory laws and work. Do you think it may be time for people to begin kind of talking across silos?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that we have been doing that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The political scientist Kathy Cohen talks about this queer politics of deviance. She has this piece. It's almost 20 years old now, and then she refashioned it later, and it's called Punks, Bulldaggers, and Welfare Queens.
Mm, yes.
You know, towards a politics, a queer politics of deviance, and question mark there she has. And she's really just talking about the political alliances that should naturally be there amongst queer people across race, amongst racial minorities, amongst women who find their reproductive rights threatened, amongst trans people, like, and ideally amongst people who have been economically marginalized in our society, regardless of their racial identities. And so she talks about this possibility of a queer coalition politics, and using the word word queer, both to symbolize kind of the sexual difference of many of the people who would be in this coalition, but also a queering of the way that we think about traditional political organizing. Mm-hmm. Thinking away from the single issue, thinking away from the single identity, how can we build this coalition of politics? The place that we see the most successful coalition of politics in contemporary American society is in the environmental justice movement, because environmental justice is a place where you have Latinx communities, Black communities, and white communities, poor white communities, Black communities of all classes, Latinx communities of all classes, coming together. There are different people that are coming from different walks of life, but they are all joined together by, like, there's a dump in their neighborhood or these kinds of things, and they're sort of organizing around place and organizing together to do this work. But few other movements have been able to do that kind of work. We see it all the time. Like if you're following Twitter, you know, the solidarity is for white women, and we certainly saw that come out in the election results, where most, you know, significant amount of white women went for Trump, even college-educated white women, 45% of them going for Trump. And so this idea that Black women have been sort of working to have solidarity with white women, but white women are like, nope. No. But that's a historical cleavage. Other historical cleavages are between white gays and Black gays, right? There's this kind of politics there where Black and Latinx gays are excluded from, oftentimes, from the organizing work and from the top of these organizations. I mean, if you look at the top of these organizations, right, there's no Black power there. There's no Latinx power there at all. And then when we think about the sort of misnomer of LGBTQ, when we have that T in there, when we are talking about people who experience life fundamentally differently, who have different sets of challenges, who need protection in different kind of ways, like, there's definitely the break off from the T. Trans organizations have had to fill in the gap where supposed LGBTQ organizations should have been there, but they were not, and they were unable to be. So these cleavages are real, and there's personalities, and there's identities, and there's dividing lines. But I do think that a coalitional politics is the only way forward. And again, we've been doing it, but not on certain kinds of levels that we need to be at, because some people can't even say Black Lives Matter. Like, seems to me, I mean, that movement for Black Lives platform is expansive and would mean justice for everyone. This is why I keep going back to anti-Blackness as a thing that we must overcome, because if we can overcome that, we can overcome a lot of these other things. It means a different world than the one we have now, for sure. I'm not sure what way we can get there in kind of this capitalist society, but there's certainly an imperative that we organize in ways that not necessarily center Black lives, but see this particular set of experiences as reflective of our country's legacy of violence and hate, that if we can overcome, we can at least begin to have a conversation about where we can go next.
Absolutely. And where we can go next, and I think for a lot of people, and this is just anecdotal, you know, from my own small sample size of people on social media, religious people, you know, I'm a religious person. I'm paid by religion. I work at a church. We're kind of trained to be automatically hopeful or optimistic, to kind of keep our heads in the sky and above the fray when things like this happen. In the question of where do we go next, can you say a little bit about kind of the rush toward healing or the rush toward, you know, I saw posts today even of, you know, like you were saying, we mourn today, we work tomorrow, this kind of idea that we just have to rush to mobilize and work. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I'm not for that. Stop it. Really. And I think we need to make space in our politics for pain and for despair from which we cannot return. I absolutely think we have to make space for that. There are reports that several trans people committed suicide. People sometimes get sad, and people sometimes despair. And so I do want there to be space in whatever we create for people to seem like they're not moving or to not move. I also want there to be space, as Ralph Ellison says, to move without moving. Like, what does that look like to stay in the stillness or to be quiet? What does it look like when our resistance is not expressive and loud and fight, but something else, something quiet in us, a revolution inside of us? So in terms of that, where are we going next? I really do think we need to let up on on a lot of us. And that includes many of us that are doing this work. Mm-hmm. We need a break. It's not like we haven't already been organizing and working. We're doing it our whole lives. We're in communities. We are talking to people. We are in our small groups. We're in group chats and group texts. And we are very much immersed in this organizing, and it's exhausting. And this is why some people just are like, deuces, I am done with this and I'm tired. And so the space to be tired and to affirm people's tiredness and to hold them and to love them through that, I think is really going to be essential for us, thinking long term for the next 4 years, but certainly for these next 2 years, which are going to be really telling in terms of what precisely is going to happen policy-wise.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Can we give Dr. Robinson a hand, please? I think, yes, that room needs to be there for people, that space needs to be there. We were at my house last night talking to friends, whatever, and, I was thinking, in my work as a priest, like, a lot of my work is literally walking into hospital rooms and just being with people and not offering them any answers, as much as I would love to, and just that presence, just being there, and, like, why don't we give our, I'm able to offer that space for other people. And why, at times, can I not offer that to myself? That there isn't always a solution. There isn't always resolution. There isn't always hope. And I think in the church specifically, we have to rediscover language for lament, mm-hmm. For pain, for despair, for suffering that's not resolved. So yeah, you've given me so much to think about. What do I say? I am Black, queer, and living in the Southern United States. These were not the election results I expected. In the coming weeks, days, months, and years, people will deliver platitudes like, God is still on the throne, or God is still in control. And these words will comfort some and not others, especially those in our midst being crushed beneath said throne. I do not know what will become of all of this. I do not know exactly what all of this means. What I do know, however, is that I will not be rushed toward healing, nor will I rush others. I will do my best to feel what I feel, to cry when I need to be confused, to be sad. I will hold space for myself and those whom I love. I will be gentle with myself at all costs. And maybe that is a holy resistance in itself. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to the staff here at America, our photographer, Mr. Josh Colfer, and our caterers, Fork in the Road. Join us on December 14th at J. Etkin Gallery with Dr. Emily Holmes. visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events. If you haven't already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks, Kevin.